Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So another very busy programme ahead of us this Monday night here on RT Radio 1 with the Mooney Goes Wild team delving into the world of natural history in all its forms. In studio with me, he's made a journey in from Greystones in County Wicklow. It's Niall Hatch. Change of scenery for you, Niall.
It is. It's really nice to be away from Greystones at the moment, down here in the basements of RTE.
It's a bunker. We're below ground. Subterranean, isn't that what they would say? I'm only waiting for a tube to pass by at any moment. There it goes. Anyway, let's go to County Wicklow now and say hello to Eric Dempsey. He hasn't been on the programme for a while. How's things in your part of the world, Eric?
Oh, they're very well, Derek. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sitting in my little studio upstairs with the garden outside, looking out onto the garden at the moment.
And a fine garden you have too, and rolling countryside behind you.
It's a beautiful area, I have to admit. And, you know, we're just south of Newcastle along the coast here. And, of course, we have Birdwatch Ireland's East Coast Nature Reserve, you know, only 5 minutes from where I live. So I have the coast and I have woodlands and I have the Wicklow Mountains. It's a perfect location. I love it down here.
Paradise, absolutely. Now, Eric, you used to run the Birds of Ireland News Service. So just remind people what that was in a couple of lines.
Yeah, it was basically a news service that provided all the birders with the up-to-date reports of rare birds in Ireland. And it was a phone service. But this, of course, was before texts, you know, really became, you know, the norm. And then WhatsApp groups and Instagrams and you name it. So it was really the old way of disseminating news. And it worked for 20 autumns. I ran that for 20 autumns. So,
well, that's interesting. You say you ran it for 20 autumns, not 20 years. Why do you say it like that?
Well, I ran it for 19 years, but it included it included 20 autumns. And the autumn time is the busiest time of the year for birding. It's when rare birds are on the move. It's when young birds migrate for the first time and get lost. It's when, you know, strong Atlantic storms might blow American warblers and things across the ocean. It's when young shorebirds and waders are on the move. So the autumn time is the busiest time. So, you know, it was always my busiest time. So I always say I ran it for 20 autumns because it took real commitment, you know, to apply yourself to running bird information services in autumn time.
Why did you stop running it? Did it run away from you? What happened?
Well, it really ran its course because people had mobile phones. So news started getting out by text messages. And then with the development of WhatsApp and things like that, you had WhatsApp groups. Mm. So now, like, you know, I get news constantly coming in on a WhatsApp. People just send a quick message to a group and the news is out to hundreds of people. So when I started the Birds of Ireland News Service back in 1990, there was no such thing as mobile phones. People didn't have mobile phones. You know, you'd be, you know, ringing from your home or ringing from a coin box and trying to get, you know, updated news. You might be in Cork and you'd find out like that there was a bird only maybe 2 miles away from you. And so now the news is so instant. Everything in social media has changed. Social media has changed everything. Everything is instant, you know.
Yes, like messaging.
Yeah. I can see photographs or video clips or sound recordings of birds that were seen 5 minutes ago, you know, on a WhatsApp group. Somebody sees it, records it, presses the button and it's out there, you know. So it's extraordinary. The young birders who are active now take this for granted. I remember Ireland's first pied wheatear back in 1980. We got the news by receiving a letter from Cork. You know what I mean? You actually found out 5 days later, somebody wrote a letter to some of the birders in Dublin saying, you know, you won't believe there's a pied wheatear. Like, it's as mad as that.
And by the time you received the letter, the bird was gone.
Should the bird be gone? Well, yeah. Thankfully, that bird stayed around. But, like, that's how news was passed around back when I started birding, when I was only a wee lad, as they say.
Well, anyway, the service may be gone. The telephone service that you ran, Birds of Ireland News Service, is gone. But yeah, the birds, it's autumn, are still coming in. So is there anything rare around at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, in recent days, there's been a fair few birds have turned up. We've had sort of easterly winds and that has produced several birds called wrynecks, which are related to woodpeckers, but they're cryptically patterned. They're incredible birds and they behave almost like anteaters. They have long tongues and they go after ants. But also, like, there's been two or three very rare birds in Waterford and in Cork. For example, there is a Blythe's reed warbler. Now, that's a very brown, small, nondescript little bird for people who aren't birders, but it's an exceptionally rare bird. There was a booted warbler, another very rare bird, has turned up, and a lesser grey shrike has been found in County Cork. And that's a really interesting one, because there's only been a handful of these species. They're like miniature birds of prey, but this bird has colour rings on it. And the colour rings show that it is from a reintroduction programme that took place in Catalonia in Spain. So in areas where these birds used to breed previously, there's an effort to reintroduce them. So these birds have been hand-reared and released into the wild as young birds. And this bird has migrated the wrong direction, as young birds tend to do, and has turned up in County Cork. So there's been a great spate of some good rare birds, and it's early yet. September is only really kicking off. September and then into October. October is when you know, birders are on high alert, and you live on your nerves, Derek, you know, because the next phone call for twitchers, they could be going from Donegal to County Cork. It's a wonderful time of the year. I love autumn. And of course, that's the reason my memoirs were called Don't Die in Autumn.
Eric, you mentioned there about the lesser grey shrike down in Cork, and I have to admit that shrikes are one of my favourite group of birds. There's just something really amazing about them. For those who don't know them, they're a songbird, essentially, a member of the same general order group of birds as sparrows and warblers and so on, but they're predatory. They've evolved to be like birds of prey with their hooked beaks, and I believe that this shrike down in Cork has actually been seen catching and skinning mice.
Yeah, I was talking to someone recently who, in the space of about 20 minutes, saw this shrike swoop down and catch two individual mice in a field. They're also known as butcher birds, because if there's a lot of prey around, they will catch four or five mice and they will impale them on, you know, thorns and bushes to eat at a later stage during the day or even the following day. So oftentimes you come across this little larder of prey. It could even be beetles, it could be worms, it could be a mouse, all impaled on hooks, waiting for when the shrike needs to feed. But this particular bird caught two mice within 20 minutes, you know, killed them, and then apparently skinned them and ate them totally, but left the skin sort of stuck on the wall. Somebody said it was like a leaf, you know, hanging. You know, they are incredible birds, quite vicious. I remember, vicious is a wrong word, but quite aggressive. I remember many years ago, one was caught in a mist net on Saltees many, many years ago, redback shrike. And it's the only time I've ever seen a bird angry. You know, most birds, when you take them out of a mist net, as you know, Noel, you know, they're quite placid and they sit and you can hold them. This bird was like shouting at the ringer, and then it started to sort of attack the ringer's hand, and it was peeling back lumps of skin. There was blood pouring down this poor ringer's hand. So yeah, they are quite an aggressive little bird of prey, even though they're a passerine. They're extraordinary birds.
And they're really well adapted for this predatory lifestyle, because not only do they have that hooked beak that we normally associate with birds of prey for tearing flesh and for killing, they also have this black eye mask, a bit like a Zorro mask, let's say.
Yes.
And a few weeks ago on the programme, we were talking about how members of the falcon family have something similar. So the moustachial stripes, as we call them, of the peregrine falcon, of many other falcons. And this appears to be an adaptation to absorb glare, essentially, prevent the glare from the sun affecting the bird's eyesight. And so predatory are the shrikes. The shrikes also have this really well-defined black mask on their faces. It just shows how evolution has perfected their hunting abilities. Well,
absolutely. They are perfect mini birds of prey without being birds of prey. And as you say, that black mask, it's a bit like Fulmers, you know, out at sea. They have this sort of black mark in front of their eye, which takes the glare from the sea as well. So yeah, that's a real evolutionary adaptation to their lifestyle.
And as you said, Niall, you lived in America for quite a while, in upstate New York.
Yep.
You said that the American football teams, when you see the players with the black stripes under the eyes, it's for the same reason, but it has a name, hasn't it?
Yes, Derek, on birds and on other predatory species that have these, such as cheetahs, for example, they're called malar stripes. And that really defines a region of the face. It's kind of a technical biological term for that region of the bird's face. Also, on the falcons, the ones that extend down below the eyes are sometimes called the moustachial stripes as well, because they kind of resemble a little bit like a handlebar moustache. And different species have them for different reasons. So many predatory species have them, but also some of the prey have them too. So you see them on some of the antelopes out in the African savannas that obviously have to have really good eyesight to spot a cheetah running towards them so they can get away. And so it seems to be a technique that's evolved to avoid the glare from the sun. And that's why the American footballers use them as well. So it's really interesting that they do that. Of course, this time of year, Eric, when we have all of these rare birds turning up in Ireland, I think that in some ways, the most exciting part is the potential, the anticipation of it, isn't it? Because you never know what's just around the corner.
That's the point. Like, that's what gets you out. You know, you actually travel off out, you know, maybe to Cork or down to Wexford, and you've no idea what you're going to see. And oftentimes you see nothing. You know, you come back with like nothing exciting having been seen, but it's the potential that around the next corner, there could be, you know, a first record for Ireland or a first record for Europe, you know, sitting in a tree or in a marsh right in front of you. And it's that potential in the autumn time that keeps birders going all day. And it's, you know, it's the drive, you know, that just maybe, you know, and you look at the forecasts and you're trying to figure out, like, will southeasterly winds, you know, that where should we be? You know, if you see like the remnants of a hurricane coming across, you go, okay, I need to get to Cork. Definitely, this could throw up American warblers or something. So you become an expert in weather forecasting, climactic changes, and you become an expert at trying to judge where you should be, and 9 times out of 10 you're usually in the wrong place. Well, that's the story of my life anyway.
Not at all. You're in the right place all the time, Eric. You're just not where the birds are, but you're
that's
in the
exactly
right place.
It, yeah.
And listen, I don't know if you saw the story during the week. You're talking about news travelling fast nowadays and instant messaging and all of that kind of stuff. Well, God bless us, we've got the internet and we've got radio. Thank God, still got radio. There was a great story from Taronga Zoo, now that's in Sydney, Australia, about a lyrebird. Now, if you're fans of David Attenborough, you would have seen him with the lyrebird on one of his many documentaries. But at any rate, Niall, I just want you to set the scene. What is a lyrebird? Why was David Attenborough interested in them anyway?
So the lyrebird, it's a well-known Australian species, often one of the symbols of the Australian woodlands, particularly in the eastern part of Australia. And at first glance, it wouldn't seem to be terribly impressive. It's a sort of medium-sized, fairly brown bird. But they have this amazing breeding display where the males can flare out this big tail and it looks like an old-fashioned lyre, like the old musical instrument. So that itself is pretty flamboyant and spectacular for a bird that otherwise would look very drab and is hiding around in the undergrowth. However, that's only the second most remarkable thing about this bird. The most amazing thing is that they are perhaps the greatest vocal mimics in the whole animal kingdom, because they imitate sounds in their environment. And of course, when they started doing this before humans were on the scene, what happened was that they would have been imitating mainly the sounds of the other birds around them, and they still do that. But of course, now that humans have encroached on their territories, more and more they're picking up the sounds of in the environment. So very often the sound of a chainsaw or the sound of a clicking motor drive on a camera or a car alarm. Sometimes it's even the sound of workers chattering, those kind of things. And especially in a zoo environment where, of course, they're hearing more artificial sounds than natural sounds, very soon their vocal techniques become skewed and they mimic more human sounds than avian sounds. It's really remarkable what they can do.
It really is. So I want you to have a listen and ask yourself, is this human or is this avian? Have a listen to this, recorded at Taronga Zoo in Sydney, Australia. That is the sound of the aforementioned lyrebird. Its name is Echo, and it's mimicking the cry of a baby. Can you believe it?
Well, the one thing that struck me, the poor parents of that child, that's the first thing that struck me. And never mind the bird mimicking it. Like, I mean, could you imagine, you know, bringing the kid to a zoo and it's having a tantrum and then the lyrebird picking up on that? They are extraordinary birds. There's only two species of lyrebird in the world, Alberts and superb lyrebird. I've managed to see both in Australia. Why these birds are mimicking is that they're in rainforests. So they need to really impress a female, and their plumage is dull because in a rainforest you can't be seen. So they take on all these sounds to impress the female. And of course, the longer and more complex your repertoire, the longer you have lived, because you have to learn all of these mimics. You have to learn all these sort of different techniques to sing. And if you have lived long, it means you're successful. If you're successful, then the females are more attracted to you. So these birds are using mimicry, not just to sort of display, here I am, this is where you find me, because they have a little display area once the female comes in. So the female has to find it, but the female has to be impressed with the song. And if the song isn't good, he will not be successful. And this is the same with many, many species. If females are able to judge the quality of a male by the quality of the song, they've said that willow warblers, for example, if they're not good singers, it means that they are not strong and healthy. Therefore, they don't have a good territory. If they don't have a good territory, the female will think, well, you know what? This guy is no good. He's not strong enough to, you know, for me to spend my time with and, you know, pass on my genes. So females are extremely choosy. So these birds begin to mimic, to incorporate a whole range of different songs. And lyrebirds are the best in the world at doing this.
It really is remarkable just how much that sounds like a baby. I would say that that is identical. I'd say it's an indistinguishable sound from a crying baby. So that the bird can mimic that so closely is incredible. And of course, they're hardwired to do this. There's some species of birds that are well known for mimicking. There's some birds, many birds, indeed most, that don't mimic sounds at all, as far as we know. And it does seem to be that. It's a way, isn't it, of advertising. First of all, I've lived a long time, so I have really good genes. I'm also able to look after myself, so I'll make a good provider for you, the female, and for any chicks that we might have together. And also it shows that that particular bird must have a really good varied territory because it's encountering so many different sounds. So this is the way that it impresses and advertises. But I think what's perhaps most remarkable about it is that the way in which the baby and the bird produce the sound is completely different. So what the baby does, of course, it's basically, as far as the baby is concerned, is speaking. It's using its vocal cords to make that sound, which instantly when a human hears it, it causes actually discomfort and distress because we want to help that baby. We're hardwired evolutionary to not really stand that sound for long. For the bird, it doesn't know what this sound is, but it's not producing it using vocal cords. So vocal cords for a human in our larynx, it's like vibrating pair of strings. If you think of strings on a violin or a guitar or a piano or something like that, in a very rudimentary sense, you have vibrating cords that are then being amplified by our voice box, and we project that out through our mouths and through our chest cavity, and that's how we make sound. However, that's not a terribly efficient way to make sound because there's a lot of wear and tear. There's a lot of moving parts there. And that's why if we speak for too long or we shout too loudly, it actually damages our vocal cords and we actually go hoarse. Now, with a bird, if you're going to be shouting at the top of your lungs for a whole day or for many days on end, having vocal cords like that would be very inefficient. There'd be a lot of wear and tear. So they have a completely different structure called a syrinx or a syrinx. And rather than being a pair of vibrating strings, instead what it is, it's actually a pair of essentially organ pipes that air is blowing through. And so there's far fewer moving parts. And they change the sound by contracting or expanding the walls of those tubes. And what they're able to do as well, unlike us, they're able to control both of those tubes independently. So those birds can harmonize with themselves, make more than one note at a time, which means that they can be much more melodic and varied and rich. And that's why bird song seems to resonate so much with us, because it's just so melodic. There's harmonies in there. It's absolutely beautiful. But also it's way more efficient because we can only make sound, and so can the baby, when it is breathing out. So you'll obviously, people who are familiar with crying babies will know that screaming sound. And then there's a pause as the baby's gasping for breath, and then comes the next bout of crying. With the birds, they don't have to do that. They can make the sound whether they're breathing in or breathing out. So it's far more efficient. I just think it's remarkable how this, so the bird doesn't realize that this is a crying baby. But for the bird, this is an interesting sound that has occurred in its environment. And I think something that perhaps might be unique to its territory. So it's obviously not thinking about this. It's hardwired to try and replicate these complicated sounds. And then it mimics them and performs them in the hope of trying to impress a female, or maybe more than one female, with their vocal prowess. It might be thinking, this is a song I've never, or a sound I've never encountered before. This is probably going to be impressive to a female. I've never heard any other lyrebird do this, so this will really make me stand out from the crowd. And that's what it's doing. So it doesn't realise what a baby is. It doesn't know what this sound means. It's just mimicking it because it found an interesting sound in its environment.
One of the best mimics we have in Ireland is a starling. And I've been fooled by starlings doing perfect, absolutely perfect lapwing calls. I had a starling that was in my garden frequently about 2 years ago, and he did perfect curlew calls. I've had starlings doing corncrakes, as well as things like car alarms and all sorts of things. But it sounds perhaps that they hear constantly. It's a sound that's picked up and is repeated. And, you know, that starling may well have been raised near the coast, so it hears curlews. The bird that was doing the lapwing was out on Inishbofin. I've even heard starlings doing perfect red kite
Inspire
calls.
Inspire your senses.
So it's something that
the
they hear.
Electric EV6,
but the lyrebird
Kia,
surely would only have been exposed to a baby screaming like that just once. It's not something that it would hear on a constant basis unless, you know, the zoo was particularly noted for screaming babies. So it must have picked up that sound very, very quickly. That, to me, of all the sounds, you know, that's the extraordinary thing about that particular sound piece. That bird must have picked that sound up very, very quickly.
Yes, Eric, I think we could almost think of it like a recording, a biological recording. It's not just mimicking a generic baby, it's mimicking a specific baby that it heard once. So it's almost like it recorded it on an audio device, which I find remarkable. I remember hearing a really amazing recording by the same species, the superb lyrebird, in the wild, I think this one was, and it was of humans talking. Now, it wasn't like a parrot repeating speech of one person. It was the sound of multiple humans chattering simultaneously, which is just amazing. How a bird could mimic and synthesize such a complex series of essentially vibrations of air is astonishing.
More details on this and every other story in today's program on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Time now to travel to Dublin 15 to Terry Flanagan's home. He was out for us during the week looking at Brent geese and what they feed on. Hello, Terry. How are you today? All good?
Yes, great, Eric. I was out with Niall, and it's that time of year again when the Brent geese come back to Dublin. And of course, they are synonymous with Dublin. They travel from the High Arctic, and large numbers of them arrive here, and they need to fatten up. They need to replenish that lost energy. And when they come to Dublin Bay, they feed on the eelgrass. Now, the eelgrass is sometimes known as seagrass. However, it's becoming scarcer here in Dublin, and this could lead to a problem for the Brent geese. Rita Hagen has recently completed her postgrad studies on this, the eelgrass, Dublin Bay. And yesterday, Niall and I met up with Rita on Merrion Strand.
Mind your step there, Terry. We're walking into the eelgrass here.
Yeah, there's a few potholes here as well. So this is the eelgrass. I would have called this a seaweed.
No, this is the seagrass. It is an angiosperm, a flowering water marine plant.
That's something I never knew, because I'm looking around here and I can see things like ulva, which is the sea lettuce and so on, which I always thought they don't produce flowers. But this particular plant, this eelgrass, does produce flowers.
It does indeed, yes.
And you have studied this now for a number of years.
I graduated from NUI Galway with a master's in coastal and marine environment in 2019, and I did my final thesis on this seagrass bed here.
And here now we're on Merrion Strand, or Sandy Mount Strand.
Yes, this is the Merrion Strand part of Sandy Mount Strand, and yes, I was monitoring the changes within the growth period in 2019 within the seagrass bed, and also investigating what pressures it was under.
Okay, so what is the importance of this particular seagrass? Because it's here all the time. People walk by it. They don't seem to do anything or notice it. Why is it important to you?
This seagrass is particularly important for the Brent geese. It's their favourite food when they come here. It's very protein-rich and nutritious for them.
And joining us also is Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland. Mention of Brent geese, they're on their way.
They are one of my favourite birds, and it's always a real treat when they do arrive. They're long-distance migrants. They come to us from Arctic Canada. So when they arrive here in Dublin and around Dublin Bay, they are starving. They've just made a huge journey, so they want the most energy, nutrient-rich food they can get, and that's where the eelgrass really comes into its own.
So when these Brent geese come, I think they come from Carlingford Lough, do they? They all tend to congregate up there and then head down here.
That's right. There's sort of a staging point there. So what will happen is the birds will cross the Atlantic and they'll come across Ireland. They tend not to stop too much on the west coast. They head mostly to Carlingford Lough, and then shortly after that they'll head then south to Dublin Bay.
And when they come here, it's for a feed.
It is, yes, because that's the reason they're here altogether. In the wintertime, obviously, there's no food available to them where they breed in the high Arctic. It's completely covered with ice. So they come here to Western Europe in order to feed, and then they'll return back to Canada to breed again. So this feeding is really important. It's really what fuels their entire breeding.
And this feeding is on eelgrass?
Eelgrass is certainly their preferred food, yes. At the early stage, that's right. Obviously, when that's depleted, they have to move elsewhere. They'll move into other grass, particularly on playing fields, around golf courses, places like that. Even on roundabouts, sometimes around Dublin, you will see them doing that. But that's their second choice of food. The eelgrass is what they really want.
But there's an issue now with the eelgrass here on Sandyman Strand. Rita, explain.
There is a lot of pressure on the seagrass here. One pressure is that people are walking on it more with their dogs. They do not really know that it is such an important species. And with the walking and cycling and dogs running through it, the roots and rhizomes can dislodge and deteriorate the health of the seagrass.
And that, a lot of that probably comes too from COVID, because more people are getting out for walks and going for walks on the strand and putting on the wellies, just like we've done today, and walking literally across it.
Yes, that's right. I have a little citizen science group here by the Rockhill residents. They've been helping me with observations, and James Cassidy, who is the leader of the group, has informed me that there is a lot of people walking here during COVID, and people working more from home and able to get out more into the
onto the beach here, yeah. I'm just looking down at it here, where we can see it here. It's really beautiful. I can see why it's called eelgrass there, because it looks like an eel.
Yes, and it's it looks like grass as well.
Yes.
It looks like grass.
And I presume when the tide comes in, it stands upright.
It does, yes.
See, it's lying on the ground here now. It looks pretty innocuous here, inconspicuous.
Yes, when the tide is out, it lies on the grass. Oh. But it's also very important habitat for small fish and small shellfish.
Yeah.
And of course,
it's providing oxygen as well in the water.
It is.
But now, mentioning of oxygen, I see here just around us, it's there's a lot of very, very black pools. And to me, that indicates anaerobic conditions.
That's right. There are a lot of anaerobic conditions here. In 2019, when I did my thesis, it was really bad. There was a large, very large patch with the cockles dying in it and the seagrass going white and bleached.
Anaerobic, what that really means is without oxygen in the soil, and the soil here is the sand, and the animals and the plants that live here, they actually need oxygen. So, like you've mentioned there, the cockles, if they're not going to get oxygen, they have to either move on or die, and in this case it's probably die.
Yes, we saw a lot of cockles coming up to the surface and dying.
And Niall, you've been studying the brent geese, you've lived here for many years. Have you noticed any change in the population of brent geese here on Merrion Strand?
Well, what we've seen is changes in their movements and behaviour, certainly. Strange as it may seem, the population of brent geese has actually been increasing around Dublin, which has put more pressure on the traditional feeding areas, because what we've been seeing is that this bird has been, for the moment, perhaps positively affected by climate change in the Arctic regions. They have a longer breeding season, more chance of success, but obviously that's worrying in itself, because long term that's not sustainable, and there's a threat that predators like Arctic foxes may be then able to get to their territories in the breeding season. So the sustainability of the population here in the winter in Ireland is something that we are concerned about. And because of the disruption that we're seeing through the disappearance of feeding areas like some of the eelgrass, also disturbance by humans and by dogs and by vehicles on the beaches, this is pushing these hungry geese to other areas where they're coming into more conflict with people. They're going onto golf courses and so forth, and some people don't like that.
Am I right in saying that the brent goose is now on the amber list?
It is. It's on the amber list in Ireland, because although the population has been showing a positive trend, it's still concentrated in just very few sites. So it's kind of you don't want all your eggs in one basket, essentially.
And the reason why it's on the amber list is purely because of this small number of feeding sites with eelgrass.
Yes, there's very little potential for expansion there, and we're not seeing the eelgrass spreading. In fact, we're seeing it retracting in many areas. So there's very few patches of this around Dublin, and so this is a real concern. And that, of course, is the main food that the brent geese come here for. And of course, what's really important to note too is that the brent geese that come to us here in Ireland, particularly around Dublin, they're really special because they're from the high Canadian Arctic population, and a huge proportion of that North American population come to us here in Ireland. We have particular international importance here in Dublin for these Canadian brent geese.
They're the light-bellied brent goose, is that right?
That's absolutely right, Terry.
It's a
yes.
lovely name, isn't it?
It is, yes, and they really have this lovely sort of pale, almost creamy effect on their chests. The ones that if you see them, for example, in much of England, for example, they have much darker bellies, like they've been rolling in soot or something like that, and that's a sign that they're from this Siberian population. And then there's another form as well called the Black Brant, because in North America our brant is called the Brant.
Yeah.
And in the sort of the western half of Canada into Alaska and parts of Siberia too, you also have this very, very dark form. And occasionally we get some of these birds mixed in with our brant here, maybe, a tiny proportion.
To
make it interesting, absolutely.
Okay. So we have a problem here. Are you worried in Birdwatch Ireland about that?
Yes, the brent goose certainly is on our radar at the moment as having problems, because it is coming more and more
into conflict with people. And of course, people will notice too, or people who are familiar with the geese will see that they tend not to be terribly frightened of people. People can get closer than they might expect. We all know the expression to go on a wild goose chase because wild geese are so skittish. But actually, where these geese spend their summers, there are very few human beings. So they haven't really learned to associate humans much with danger. So that means people think it's okay to walk up close to them or even to let their dogs run at them and think they're not causing any effect on these birds. But in fact, they are. They're causing them stress. The birds don't show it the way that we might show stress, but it is affecting their heart rate. It's affecting their whole biology. And this can then affect them when they're going to breed. Also, it meaning that they're not getting the maximum opportunity to feed. And that's what they really need, because the nutrition that they get from grass, it's actually very little. They have to eat huge quantities of that in order to process it. It's the same for all grazing animals. So they need to feed pretty much all the daylight hours that they can. And when they're interrupted or disturbed, that really does affect their productivity and survival.
So really, we need to do something about the eelgrass, is that right?
Yeah, yes, we do. I mean, here on the beach, it's such an important source of food for these geese, and also for all sorts of other marine wildlife as well. And yet, I'm sure that most people walking on the beach aren't even aware of it. It doesn't look that spectacular until you look very closely at it, and then it's amazing stuff. But I'm sure some people even think it's maybe a form of pollution or something something unwanted on the beach. And I think that's a big part of the problem. I think more awareness needs to be raised for the importance of this and the dangers that people pose to it.
Okay, awareness, Rita. What can we do?
Yes, I do agree with Niall. People don't really realise it's an important species, and awareness it's about this programme, for example, is a good way of making awareness. And our local residents, they have started putting up their own signs, so more signage would be needed. And
signage, for instance, for people not to walk across the grass and not to walk their dogs across it.
Exactly, and also to inform that this is an important species and this is a protected area. And I must say that Dublin City Council has been very supportive of the work that's going on here to protect the eelgrass, and they are working on a management plan for South Dublin Bay at the moment as well.
Final word, Niall. Are you worried, or how do you feel about it?
I'm certainly encouraged that the profile of this is being raised and it's being identified as being very important, and research is going into it. But of course, we do need action from the authorities to make sure that this really important habitat is protected and properly appreciated.
Lovely report there, Terry. And thanks again to Rita Hagen. You wanted to ask Eric something, Terry?
Well, no, I was just wondering how much of the eelgrass there is down County Wicklow way, because what Rita said to me was that there's very few places in Dublin where the eelgrass is now. Is there much of it down in Wicklow? I know you've been out studying it, Eric.
No, not an awful lot. In Wicklow, we have sort of a sandy coast. There's very few estuaries down along the Wicklow coast, you know, of the calibre of Dublin Bay. So a lot of the studies I was doing with the Brent geese were the birds feeding on what's called ex situ sites, basically birds that are feeding inland from the coast, feeding on football pitches and feeding on grass that are found on the playing fields around schools and things. So I was trying to look at where the geese were going when they left the coast, rather than watching the birds on the coast. So it is very interesting that a lot of the Brent geese are beginning to sort of evolve to move onto football pitches. And all around Dublin, I mean, it's well known that some of the best feeding sites now are places like the Phoenix Park. There was a flock of 2,000 Brent geese feeding on the 40 acres in the Phoenix Park last winter. So the birds are evolving to move away from the coasts as eelgrass diminishes as the winter goes on. So a lot of Brent geese are coming back into Dublin each year, into Ireland. The population is increasing, which is really, really good. But they are now using up the eelgrass much, much faster each year. And as a result, are then moving out onto the football pitches. So they have found an available food source all around the country. They're feeding on grass, on pitches and playing fields all over the country now along the coast.
So, Eric, just before we say goodbye to you, will you get a chance to see any of those rare visitors, do you think?
I am hoping to. You know, I'm planning to take a week in October off where I can just bird my brains out. So that's my plan in October.
Okay, well, good luck to you. Thanks, Eric. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Derek. Take care of yourself.
And thanks to you as well, Terry.
Okay, Derek, talk next week.
Bye. There goes Terry and there goes Eric. And fascinating stuff it is too, I have to say. Now, ash. The ash tree is one of Ireland's most widespread native trees. It is found in over 90% of our native woodlands and supports a variety of wildlife. However, in less than 10 years since it was first detected here in Ireland in Leitrim, back in 2012, it may have been here before that, ash dieback is wiping out the valuable species with a devastating impact on biodiversity, forests and hedgerows right across the country. Recently, Éin an Ilana spoke with Meath farmer and forester Joe Barry about his take on ash dieback.
So I'm talking to Joe Barry, who is a landowner in County Meath, and he's in the ancient and venerable district of Kilcock in County Meath. How are you today, Joe?
I'm great, Éin. A lovely day. Sun is shining here.
Now, I'm going to talk to you today about ash trees, and in particular about ash dieback. You are very worried and concerned about ash dieback. Now, first of all, will we explain what ash dieback is? What is ash dieback, Joe?
Well, it's a disease called Calara fraxinea. It's a fungal disease carried by the wind. There's no way you can stop it arriving. It just blows. It's been right across Europe. It's wiped out over 90% of the trees in Poland and other Eastern European countries. It's hit Britain and it's hit us very bad. I was just driving home from Kilcock this morning and you can see clear signs that about 70% of the trees between my house and Kilcock, about 3 miles of a country road, that about 70% at least are infected by it and they're dying. Some are totally dead.
Now, this is a very recent disease. It only came into Ireland in 2012, which is only 8-9 years ago. So it has spread very rapidly. And
I think maybe we should qualify
that,
Éin. It came in on
trees. It was actually because you would have hoped us being an island, we'd escape such things. But it came in on trees that were coming from a nursery in Poland. And it started out in County Leitrim, in actual fact. So how would you know a tree, Joe, looking at it, that it wasn't hit by lightning?
Well, sorry, can I just qualify that a little bit?
How would you know what it looked like?
Can I qualify that a little bit, just what you said there? I think we've had it a lot longer than when it was first discovered. In fact, I think I've had it in my woods here and nobody seemed to know what it was. We assume maybe it was a form of canker or it was something about translocation of something through the roots. We weren't sure. And it was only when Dermot Houlihan, it was the forester, discovered what actually identified it in County Leitrim. But that wasn't when it first arrived. It was definitely here before that. And it may well have blown on the wind as opposed to coming in on saplings from abroad.
That's interesting, because you think it could have come in on the wind, because it's the same general family of fungal infection as potato blight. And we all know the potato blight came on the wind from Britain. So that's a perfectly plausible explanation of why it is so widespread so quickly. But tell me, how would you know what it looked like if you saw a dead tree or a dying tree? How would you know it was dieback rather than some other disease or being hit by lightning or something of that order? How would you know it was cholera?
It's so common now that it's quite easy. Anyone can just drive out into the countryside or wherever and they'll see it. They'll see it all over the place. The branches, the outer branches and the leaders are tend to die back. Sometimes it might be just one or two branches. Maybe it could be half the tree. And you just see them dying back and just sort of wilting at the tip of the branch. And then it just slowly dies back. And as it advances, lesions appear on the branches. And they're quite obvious as it gets advanced. And then on the older trees, and we only discovered this when we were thinning trees a couple of years ago, this centre of the tree then starts to rot, literally. You get a brown stain right up through the centre of the tree. And that unfortunately leaves the tree valueless for use as hurley butts, for example, and spoils its value for furniture or whatever other use you might be able to make of it. So it's really firewood. It's a write-off. And I think at this point we have to realise that climate change, for whatever reason, is bringing in a lot of diseases into Ireland, and our obsession with planting native species only must change, because we've only a tiny number of native species. I mean, what else have you? Besides, ash is gone, elm's gone, oak is under threat to a degree, and we need to mix our species and plant more varieties and not have this obsession of people being against conifers, for example, which are incredibly useful and thank goodness are still growing healthily in the countryside.
So Joe, you're particularly invested in this because you actually planted a plantation of ash trees way back in the 1990s, up to I don't know how many hectares of it you planted, and you planted this as a crop under encouragement because we wanted lots of trees for Hurleys. So how is your plantation looking now 30 years later?
Well, I planted in total on the farm here, I'll talk in acres if you don't mind, I'm old fashioned, I planted 100 acres. And I planted it with a mixture of broadleaves of various species and conifers and anything I could sort of felt would do well in this climate. And I was advised, obviously, by my forester, who was excellent, a guy called Donald Keegan. And he gave terrific advice. And we planted among the whole thing 40 acres of ash. And we worked very hard to mind it, and we thinned it out three times carefully, going in with interventions to allow the trees to grow straight and true. We did high pruning. We did everything we possibly could to create a final crop of valuable trees that would be good for hurley butts or furniture, whatever. And we now, in the last couple of years, we've realised we have the entire plantation is infected with Calara. And it all has to go. We simply have to remove them all. There's nothing else we can do. And that's really where I'm at the moment. And unfortunately, I am at a huge financial loss, but then that's not really the issue, I suppose, that we're really worried about at the moment. But farmers in general are at a major financial loss from this because they have to start again without any forestry premium, which was paid for the first 20 years when we planted originally.
Yes, and as well as that, and bad and all as that is, ash is also our most common hedgerow canopy tree. I mean, 20, 40 years ago, we had elm and ash in our hedgerows. And as we know, the elm was killed out completely, you might say, with Dutch elm disease. You see it coming back, but once it gets to 12 or 13 years of age and gets big enough for the beetle to come back, it gets hit again. So ash is really our only common and widespread hedgerow tree. And now it's presumably all been hit by the Calara as well, which reduces enormously the biodiversity in these linear woodlands, which the hedgerows are. So this, apart from the economic disaster that you're describing, this is also a biodiversity disaster if we lose our other main canopy tree for fertile soils, which is where you live, that kind of soil conditions, which suits ash so very well.
Yeah, I've been looking at a very varied environment here where I farm, most farmers do. And we farm in a pretty close to nature manner, and we have a huge variety of species. And I think the loss of ash, maybe it's not as dramatic as we might think. There's no reason why we can't set about replanting our hedgerows with mixed species and varied species, and nature can be very forgiving from my observing of it over the years. And it's quite extraordinary how this farm here is just absolutely alive with wildlife, and I don't think the loss of the ash is going to hugely damage the biodiversity in the farm, provided we replant, if the Forest Service will allow us, and that's another day's work entirely. But if we replant with another species, the natural world will just move in and inhabit.
Now, you're saying that you're very concerned with the obsession, as you call it, with what we call native species, species that arrived here under their own steam after the Ice Age, and things that didn't arrive here under their own steam because our island had been cut off by that point, but arrived in Britain under their own steam, things like beech. I mean, they have plenty of biodiversity in them. So I think you're right about your observation that as the world warms up, as climate change changes our temperatures and our climatic conditions here in Ireland, our conditions for growing species that might have grown better further south, these conditions will be now more suitable for these kind of trees. And it is a blinkered approach to say, of the 28 native species, we're losing them and we're not replacing them with anything else because these are the holy grail. That this is actually something that will have to be grasped. And then the second point you're making, of course, is about conifers and how really well conifers will grow in Ireland, given that they have leaves all the year round and they can grow all the year round, and our winters are warm enough to allow them to grow in the winter time. It means conifers do particularly well here in Ireland, and certainly as a forestry crop can be a very useful one, considering that they grow so much faster than deciduous trees.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more with you. And again, there's a misconception that somehow the conifers are in some way bad. There's absolutely, the old way of managing them, going back in the early days of the Forest Service, was that they were planted in blocks, very unsightly sort of blocks out in the sides of hillsides and stuff like that. It's completely changed now, and people have to work with the landscape. And a conifer wood contains, I mean, things like the nightjar, a very rare bird, loves conifer trees. And I can never understand why people sort of will object, oh, you can't plant trees there, that's a lovely grassy field. But you can plough it for wheat. And that means that the ground nesting birds have no chance. The general sort of use of monocultures of ryegrass, of corn or whatever, and the amount of fertilizers and chemicals that go in those crops. Now, I won't make myself any friends with farmers by saying this, but to my mind, a field of Sitka spruce is 100% more environmentally friendly than a field of wheat.
And as well as that, I mean, if you want to plant a field of Sitka spruce nowadays, the regulations for planting something like that include spaces being allowed for biodiversity, include the addition of other species that aren't Sitka spruce. Your license to plant a crop of Sitka spruce is tempered by the regulations making the person planting them include other species and include open spaces for biodiversity. And of course, you're not allowed any longer, and haven't been for the last 40 years allowed, to plant Sitka spruce on bogs. Yet people still persist in complaining, oh, there's monocultures of Sitka spruce being planted on bogs every day of the week. I mean, this is such an untruth. But people see them there because they have been planted 40, 50, 60 years ago when people were differently aware. So we really have to point out that this does not happen any longer. Forestry is much better managed. The problem with forestry at the moment in Ireland is that we are not planting enough trees. Now, I don't mean replanting places that have been forested. I'm speaking of afforestation, where you put down trees where there were no trees before, trying to increase the amount of cover that we have in Ireland under forestry. And really, that is something that should be tackled. This whole idea of afforestation, of requiring planning permission or a license to actually plant trees, all of this has really strangled forestry at the moment with all this red tape that is necessary.
And it's marvellous to hear you say that, because I'm tired saying exactly the same thing. I mean, take my situation at the moment. You get a 5-year felling licence, which means you can continue to manage your trees, and then it's reassessed every 5 years and you apply for another one. Normally that took 4 to 6 months. Fair enough. It now takes 2 years. I currently cannot go in and manage my trees. I have 8 acres of sycamore, very fine trees, urgently in need of thinning out to allow them, respace them, to allow them to keep growing. I'm not allowed to go near them and not allowed to touch them. Yet in Germany and in Holland, two very environmentally conscious countries, they can do this in 6 months and continue to do so. So I don't understand what the problem is with Ireland specifically, but maybe you have the answer to that.
So, Joe, the other thing I wanted to bring up with you just briefly now is all of these trees are dying. Many of them are in hedgerows along the roadsides. Is this going to be a problem for landowners whose roadside hedges have dead ash trees in them? And, of course, dead trees are, particularly if there's road and traffic going by, they're going to be a hazard for that. Can they be cut down, or have you to wait 2 years to get permission for those too?
My understanding is that to cut down a roadside tree that presents a danger, you don't need permission to do it or planning permission to do that. But of course, the trouble is that with insurance issues, which are very real, it's a very costly exercise. You're looking at about £1,000 to take down a large ash at the side of the road, in terms of, you know, you have to get in qualified people, they have to insurance, and they have to do it carefully, that there'll be no danger to traffic or whatever. And farmers at the moment, as far as I can make out, are faced with having to do this. Now, this is huge when you consider what's going on around the country and the size of some of these trees. How that's going to be covered, I simply don't know, but I cannot see how farmers can possibly take this on their own shoulders and manage to remove all those trees and hopefully replant.
Well, certainly, Joe, all of this conversation at the moment about climate change, one of the things that's been offered as some sort of a solution or a panacea is to plant more trees. So it was interesting speaking to you and listening to what you have to say about the actual practical difficulties about planting trees in Ireland at the moment. With any luck and with more emphasis on the difficulties of doing something that is seen by everybody to be so good, maybe things will change. Thank you very much for talking to me, Joe.
No problem. Nice to hear from you. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much indeed to Aina and Joe Barry. Niall, you're looking at me as if you want to say something.
Well, I'm just thinking back, Derek, to the programme that you did about ash dieback for BBC Radio 4, I think.
We did, you mean? The programme we did for Radio 4, because you wrote the scripts, yeah.
Yeah, it was really interesting, wasn't it? We covered all of these invasive species and the threats that they pose, and ash dieback was one of the ones that we identified as being a particular threat.
It was a major concern then, and is now a major concern here too, so it's very appropriate that we're covering that story. Listen, just before we go, I notice in your latest edition of Wings magazine, which has been distributed to, what is it, something like 15,000 of Birdwatch Ireland members. It's fantastic. I mean, that's a great circulation. But you have a terrific article about the Manx shearwater. Now, we've got to look out for Manx shearwaters at this time of year. A little bit about the bird and why we've got to look out for them, please.
So the Manx shearwater, it's a bird that most people in Ireland probably don't know exists, but it's actually one for which we have huge international importance. It's a seabird, essentially, a relative of the albatrosses. It's about the size of a jackdaw or a pigeon. Essentially, it is dark above, almost black, very white below, and it's mostly nocturnal. They nest all around the Irish coast on offshore islands and on headlands, but they only really come out at night, so people don't see them there, except perhaps at this time of year, mm-hmm. because what happens is the young birds, these young shearwaters, have just left their nesting burrows, and what they do is they head out to sea. They actually go and look for the light of the moon, and that's where they head. But of course, with modern light pollution, what happens sometimes is that they'll actually fly inland, maybe tricked by the lights of a town or a village, and end up sometimes on roads or in car parks. This particularly seems to happen in places like Cork and in Kerry. There's reports from Dingle of this every year, for example. All the locals know what to watch out for. Now, these poor birds, these young shearwaters, they're totally helpless because they're seabirds. Their legs are set so far back on their bodies, they can't even walk. So they sort of flop on the ground, and they're then sitting ducks, of course, for things like dogs and cats, or indeed some of them get hit by cars. So what we're asking people to do, if you come across one of these shearwaters, you know, the next couple of weeks, essentially pick it up, making sure when you hold it, maybe just push its wings in with your hands.
You're gently.
Very gently. The bird itself will probably be very docile. It'll never have seen a human before. They haven't even really evolved to have fear of humans. So it'll be very gentle and probably bemused. Pick it up, put it into a box, and wait until that night. There's no need to try to give it food or water. Its parents will have ensured that it has enough fat reserves to survive for a few days. And then when night comes and it's pitch dark, take it to the sea and open the box and let it fly out to sea, and hopefully all will be well. And then that bird will head straight to Argentina, of all places, a journey of 11,000 kilometres, and it takes them less than 3 weeks to do that. It's remarkable.
It really is. Anyway, Niall, thank you very much indeed. You can read all about it if you're a member of Birdwatch Ireland in your Wings magazine. Or for more details, visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Niall Hatch, Terry Flanagan and Eric Dempsey. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Bella Riley. Until next week, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.